are developing elsewhere. Susan Keese, NPR News.
A Boston jury finds the world's biggest drug company, Pfizer, has violated racketeering laws by improperly promoting its drug to treat epilepsy, Neurontin. Pfizer could have to pay $141 million if it loses its planned appeals. A jury finds Pfizer illegally promoted Neurontin for unapproved uses, including treatment of migraine headaches, pain, and bipolar disorder. The plaintiffs argued Neurontin doesn't work for those conditions. Doctors may prescribe drugs for unapproved uses, but drug makers can't promote them for those uses. The plaintiffs are Kaiser Foundation Hospitals and Kaiser Foundation Health Plan. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Vintage Vinyl is coming up on Saturday, May 8th. Start packing your used CDs, records, DVDs, tapes, and working stereo equipment now. And beginning March 31st, drop them off at any Busey Bank office in Champaign, Urbana, or Savoy. Call Dean Geiken at 217-333-6503 for more information.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus 580 archives, so as you listen, do keep in mind, we'll not be taking your calls. In the first hour of our show today, we'll be talking with novelist and philosopher Rebecca Goldstein, and we'll be talking about her latest book, something that brings together really two of her major interests, writing fiction being one, and thinking about the big questions of life, which is the kind of thing that philosophers do, being the other. In fact, she says that the characters in her fiction are always people who care about deep questions, and this book perhaps takes on one of the deepest. The title of the book is 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction. And it does indeed explore something of the religious experience, what it is, what it means, and some of these larger questions about who we are and why we are here and how we should live. She also says she wants people to come away from this book with the idea that religion is about much more than a belief in God, that it is something that's innate to human nature. The book is also about the power of romantic love, something that she says is a religion that nobody doubts. The book is just recently out, has been getting very good reviews, and you can find it, I'm sure, in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. Our guest, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, received her doctorate in philosophy from Princeton. Her award-winning books include the novels The Mind-Body Problem, Properties of Light, and Mazel, and also nonfiction studies of Kurt Gödel and Baruch Spinoza. She's also received a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship and Guggenheim and Radcliffe Fellowships. She was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2005. She's joining us by telephone. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And you may also email your questions, comments to will-talk. That's just like it sounds, W-I-L-L. That's will-talk at illinois.edu. Ms. Goldstein, hello.
Hi.
Thanks. I'm good. Thank you. And how are you?
Very well.
Good.
I'm losing my voice, so I hope it won't give out.
Well, you've probably just been spending too much time talking about.
I'm so sick of hearing the sound of my own voice.
Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time. I know that there are many novels that say on the cover of the book, in addition to the title, they say a novel.
Right.
And so they say right up front, this is a work of fiction. Now, and your book also, the main title is 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, but it also says a work of fiction. And I wonder whether you or the publisher perhaps thought in this case it was particularly important that right on the front of the book it says this is a novel.
Yes, I did. I was the one who very much insisted on this. And
Instead, I mean the subtitle to be the first of what I hope are many jokes of the book, because it is, as you pointed out, it's about a very serious and weighty topic, but it's actually rather a funny novel. It's been described as a romp, this joke is that it's 36 arguments for the existence of God, a work of fiction. And I didn't mean that as a kind of mischievous comment, that these arguments, which are actually given in the appendix to the novel, are themselves a kind of work of fiction. And then one of my ardently atheist readers wrote in and said, and did you also mean to say 36 arguments for the existence of God, who is a work of fiction? You know, so yet another meaning to this title. Which is wonderful. I mean, readers actually come up with things that I never thought about.
Yeah. And I think among the things about this that pleases me, I guess, is that this is an example of a sort of a time-honored form. It's an academic novel, and it's set in university setting. And I think that if you've spent time around college towns as I have, you look at the people in the novel and you think to yourself, I think I've met these people.
Yeah, it's funny because people keep asking me about various characters. Did you mean so-and-so? Did you mean so-and-so? You know, and it's, you know, people whom I've never met and never thought about. But you know, that's, I guess, nice. You capture a certain type that is familiar to anybody who, as you say, spent time around universities. One of the themes of the book, however, is even there, you know, I'm sort of trying to make a point. One of the themes is that the religious impulse is not confined to strictly religious contexts, that it's so deeply rooted in our nature, various of the aspects of the religious reaction, that it swarms out into secular contexts as well, including academia. And so the deification of certain charismatic professors, the almost messianic, oracular style that some of these professors take on has also aspects of the religious mentality associated with them, as does one of the themes, as does the romantic love itself.
Yeah. If it, that also almost makes me wonder that whether you could come up with another term, something that would stand in for religious impulse, or perhaps you could take the word religious out of there to talk mm-hmm. about what the nature of this impulse is that does get into so many different areas, and that would put across a little bit better the idea that what we're talking about here is a kind of universal human experience that spreads into different areas of human activity, and so that would help you think about it in a little bit larger frame.
I think that's a wonderful suggestion. And even there, I mean, there's, you know, of course, the word spiritual and or transcendent, but even there, I mean, that I think is too narrow, because that's isolating the more positive aspects of what gets expressed often as religious emotion. I think it's just so multifaceted. It includes, you know, some of the most expansive, what I would call transcendent or spiritual aspects, but also some very narrowing and confining and fearful aspects that also can get expressed in religious context as well as in secular context, you know, so that you know, there's not quite the word, and the reason I do use the word religious is that I wanted this book to be set in the context of this amazingly active debate that has just exploded into the public sphere between, you know, the forces of science and reason on one side and religion on the other, or, you know, faith and reason, or that this debate between the new atheists and religion that is, you know, from the point of view of philosophy, is just fascinating, because this is the stuff of philosophy, but it's become a very public and political debate, and I wanted it, the book is set in the context of that debate.
Yeah, this is something that I was interested in hearing you talk about, because we are at a point, and we seem to be have been at this point for a couple of years, where this particular debate about religion, about the existence of God, about the whether or not organized religion is a positive or negative in society, these sorts of things. This debate has gotten a lot of attention. Some widely read books have been written, so perhaps another reason why you'd want to make sure people knew that your book was a novel and not another one of these kinds of books.
Yeah.
So that makes me wonder, why do you think it is that now this question of God's existence has become such a hot topic?
Yeah. Well, the obvious answer is, you know, what happened. I'm actually in New York right now and can actually look at the gaping hole that still exists in Lower Manhattan.
Yeah.
That was a very, very dramatic, terrifying demonstration of what unenlightened religion can wreak in our world. So that was part of the impetus. Also, I probably would have to say the eroding of the separation between church and state we were seeing under the last administration. The Committee on Bioethics, for example, which was loaded up with religious thinkers and were making very important decisions that affect all of us, like stem cell research. And I think this also kind of shook up certain segments of the society and a kind of pushback. And the other thing I think is, if you look at people who have written the popular atheist books, nonfiction books, all of whom I have to say are I know quite well, and I would count as my friends. They all come from the biological sciences, you know, from evolutionary biology, you know, or from evolutionary psychology. And I think that the advances in those sciences have given the sciences a way of explaining religious impulses. And in the case of some of these writers, explaining them away, you know, that this is a way of saying, look, there aren't any very good arguments for any of this, and we have a way of explaining why people believe nonetheless. And so we can now explain it away. And, you know, if you look at the titles, you know, The God Illusion by Dawkins or Breaking the Spell by Dan Dennett, there is that kind of assumption or a presumption that we can explain this away. So I think it's those three factors, you know, the terrorist attacks, the erosion among, you know, some political forces in America between separation of church and state and the advances in the sciences.
Yeah. Well, that, I think, gets to another question I was interested in hearing you talk about, and that is, if science, I don't think we're quite at this point, but if science gets to the point where we say we understand brain functioning so well, and we know about the chemistry of neurotransmitters, and we put people in brain scans, and we get them to think about God, and you know, we get priests and Tibetan monks, and we bring in the Dalai Lama, and we wire everybody up, and we look at what's going on in their brains, and so we finally can say, aha, you see, I can point right here. You see what's going on here, and this part of the brain is active, and these things are happening. If we get down to the point where we can come up with some very mechanistic explanation for religious experience, what have we either gained or lost?
Yeah, I think that's a very profound question, and there is actually, they have found a part of the brain that they can stimulate and induce certain kinds of mystical experiences, out-of-body experiences. And what does this prove anything at all? I think, you know, even were we to completely understand the neuroscience of these reactions, it wouldn't that in itself does not disprove the validity of these experiences. I mean, after all, romantic reactions take place in a certain part of the brain, and everything, all emotions. You know, if you are someone who, like me, believes that we are our central nervous system, that that's where all of consciousness resides, then, you know, obviously all experiences are going to be taking place in some part of the brain, and maybe one can even stimulate those parts of the brain and induce those experiences. That in itself doesn't show that these are not valid experiences. I mean, after you can actually induce, you can stimulate certain parts of the brain, and a person will be remembering so vividly as if they're going through that experience once again. It doesn't mean that they hadn't gone through that experience. So I would be, I mean, it would be an amazingly interesting, from a scientific point of view, result, but I don't think it answers this larger question that philosophers are interested in. Is there any validity to this experience? Are people confronting some sort of reality when they have this experience?
Well, that's, I suppose that does seem to be one of the big questions. That is, if people, we say that people's experience is significant and it's real, at least it's real to them, then can you say anything beyond that point? Does that point us to any sort of larger truth, or do we have to say that everyone has their own truth and we can maybe come to some sort of loose agreement on general principles, but other than that, there's no larger truth for everybody to grab onto?
Well, you know, we live in this world. There is the world, and we occupy it, we inhabit it, and we want to know the nature of this world. I call this the ontological impulse, and it seems to be pretty strong in all of us. I guess some stronger than others, but you know, that we really want to know objectively what, and when we say, you know, something exists, we're not saying it exists for me. We're usually making, you know, just a simple statement, and it seems to be a very great interest to all of us. As how could it not be? Is this, in some sense, a personal universe? Is there a personal a will that emanates throughout this universe, and in terms of which we should see our own destiny or not? Is it just us, the random products of blind processes of evolution, who somehow or other evolved this higher mind that can ask these questions? But is it just us? And it's true that sometimes people will have a kind of experience that for them carries tremendous force and seems to close off all the questions forevermore. They seem to confront some sort of reality. But the question is, for those of us who don't have that experience, are there any good grounds for believing that this is a universe permeated by some sort of divinity, some sort of divine will? So is that, I'm sort of wiggling around on both sides of the question here, but that's my response to that. That is, you know, if you haven't had this sort of experience, and we do know that these large personal experiences can be very elusive. That is, they're illusory, I mean, really delusional. People have subjective experiences of all sorts that we wouldn't want to accept. So even if it convinces them, if you're in the grip of the experience, what can you do but to believe in it? But if you're not, and you look outside, does this experience of other people, or are there other sorts of grounds, all sorts of arguments that would lead us to a reasoned, grounded belief in the existence of God?
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Rebecca Goldstein. She is a novelist. Her new book, her most recent, is titled 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction, and it's published by Pantheon.
She has a PhD in philosophy from Princeton and has taught courses in philosophy of science, philosophy of mind, philosophy of psychology, among other things. She has also authored a number of novels, including The Mind-Body Problem, Properties of Light. She's written nonfiction studies also of Kurt Gödel and Baruch Spinoza, and has been a recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, also Guggenheim and Radcliffe Fellowships. And she's talking with us this morning by telephone about the new book. Questions, comments certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Perhaps we can talk a little bit about at least your main character here. And I have to say, you know, when I started reading the book, I think one of the things that grabbed me was this man.
Oh, good.
And I thought, well, there was something very attractive and very funny and about this man, Cass Seltzer, who is a psychologist. He's a psychologist of religion at a smaller fictional university that you've created, a place called Frankfurter University. And I'm not sure whether you were thinking about the Supreme Court justice there or the sausage. Anyway, he's at this place, and he's been there for 20 years, and suddenly, because he's written this book, very much like the kind of book we have now, this best-selling book, The Varieties of Religious Illusion, with this appendix, 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, which you actually have created, and it is the appendix to your book, 36 Arguments. So he's suddenly become a very hot property, and Harvard has made him an offer, which is, you know, that's pretty much the top of getting to the top of the heap, academically speaking. So he's at this interesting point in his life. He's also very much in love, and he's at this interesting point in his life where the man who has toyed with the notion that there is no God has seen some things that might be taken for miracles.
Yes, right, exactly. And he's himself. So I have various publications. I think Time magazine dubs him the atheist with a soul, and he is a very soulful character. He himself has this tendency toward transcendence, you know, of sort of getting outside of himself in this very radical way and just reveling in existence itself, which is actually a very Spinozist emotion and can easily be expressed in religious terms, although he resists that. I mean, he's an atheist, but he's the atheist with a soul, and so he's very given to this expansive spiritual experience that he's a bit, you know, ashamed of. He says at one point, it's not becoming of America's favorite atheist to be constantly having spiritual experiences. But he is, I'm glad you like him. I like him too. He's a little bit hapless. He is somewhat subject to being taken over by personalities which are much larger than himself. But I find that lovable in him.
Yeah. Well, maybe I associated him with him because I'm a little bit hapless myself.
Me too.
I feel like, yeah, I think I know. I know that you know what it feels like to be living in a sailboat with no rudder, where you just go where the wind blows you. I'm afraid that's sort of the story in my life.
Well, then I probably like you very much. I'm very given to those kinds of characters myself.
And I'm sure that this happens, because it always happens with writers, that when people read the book and then they meet you, they talk to you, they say, now, you're Cass Seltzer, right? This is you. So how much of you did you end up pouring into him?
Life is so very different from mine, this wrestling with these questions and having wrestled with them, you know, pretty much one's entire life, and then suddenly you find that your own personal preoccupations are hitting a nerve because, you know, that something has happened, that there's been a switch. The book opens with the line, something shifted, something so immense you could call it the world. That's the first line of the novel. And, you know, I somehow feel like that here, you know, my entire life I've been preoccupied with these questions. I myself grew up in an extremely religious family. And and was filled with doubts from the very beginning, and that was one of the things that drove me towards philosophy and towards physics. Those were my two early loves. And, you know, but suddenly religion seems to be on everybody's mind. As he says, you know, fundamental and fundamentalist things that happen, and suddenly religion is a phenomenon that's on everybody's mind. And I feel like that. So that with I'm in that regard very much with Cass.
Yeah. I was interested in hearing a little bit more of your personal story. Do I have it right that your dad is a rabbi?
Well, my dad, he died a long time ago. He died quite young. And he was a rabbi. He was a cantor. But he did have ordination. Was a rabbi. And my brother is a rabbi. My brother. And I come from, my grandfather was. I come from a long line of rabbis, actually.
So you grew up in a family that was quite conservative, religiously speaking?
Yeah. We were really quite Orthodox. I was in fact sent to an all girls high school that was beyond my family. It was really very far gone, and it was and this was partly because of the tendencies that I was beginning to show, the questioning tendencies, and my family put me in a very right wing all girls high school, where we really were not even encouraged to go on to college. We really were encouraged to get married as soon as we graduated from high school and to begin to produce children one after the other. So, that was my background.
So I guess I could see how one would be attracted to philosophy. I'm not exactly sure how one would be attracted to physics or what the connections between those two things. I guess I can see the connections between those two things, but what do you see are the connections?
Yeah, between sort of religion, philosophy, physics,
yeah.
All of that.
Uh-huh.
Yes, so I remember feeling very much as a kid, everybody seemed so very certain of all sorts of, quite elaborate beliefs, and certainly beliefs about how one should behave in the world. I mean, and our way of life was so permeated by laws. I mean, there were laws for everything, and food intake, and of course the holidays and the Sabbath, and so it was just. And I had siblings, and everybody seemed to be pretty much on board with everything, and I just didn't understand how everybody could be so sure. So actually, one of the things was that we were not wealthy, to say the least. We were really quite impoverished, and we didn't own any books, but we did make much use of our public library. And so every Friday before the Sabbath would begin, I would load up on my books because there was nothing you could do on Saturday except for read. I wasn't allowed to ride my bike or nothing. And so, and one Friday I took out this, and I slowly worked my way through the entire library, and I hit on this book, I was probably about 12, called The Story of Philosophy by Will Durant. And it was my first experience of utter, actually kind of that transcendent experience that I have Cass describing at the end of the first chapter, or going through at the end of the first chapter, of just kind of an ecstasy, just being outside of yourself. And it was when I was reading the section on Plato, and I don't know how much I understood it all, but there was this sense of, beyond our experience is this formal, purely intellectual world that we could reach through reason. And we could really know what the world was like through the exercise of reason. And it was reason that everybody who went through that process would reach the same conclusion. It didn't matter what tradition you were born into or what your own very subjective experiences were. There was something, I didn't have the word objective, but that was the word that I was struggling for. That was what was coming through in this story of philosophy, and that just excited me to my core. And then I was also reading about physics, and that was the sort of same thing. that they're outside, you know, outside experience is the real world. And somehow physicists are able to describe it using mathematical language, and it seems as if time flows, but Einstein was able to reason his way to this counterintuitive view that time doesn't flow, and that this is just great, that there's something certain that could satisfy all of us if only we go through the rigorous reasoning, we'll get there. So that's sort of the way it presented itself to me, the connections between religion, philosophy, and science. Hmm.
We have a caller, a couple of them. I will get to them in just a second, just as soon as I introduce, once again, our guest, for anybody who might have just tuned in the last little bit. Rebecca Goldstein is the guest. She is a novelist, writes fiction, also has written in the area of philosophy, and her most recent book is titled 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction. It's published by Pantheon. It's out now. It's been getting very good notices, and I think you might enjoy it, so you can go and take a look at it in the bookstore or in the library. And questions are welcome to 333-9455, 800-222-9455. That's the toll-free line. And you may also email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that, starting with Urbana and line one. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
Really enjoying the show this morning. Thinking to myself, religion and science has always been kind of like oil and water. It never seems to mix very well. And God, for myself, to me it seems like a much more personal level, personal experience type of thing. I think I know that there are people who believe in God and they, get... I don't want to sound too negative, but they get ridiculous in their actions and in their faith and the way that they present themselves. And I believe that there's also people who don't believe in God who can do the same thing. A lot of negative thought out there and actions taken upon negative thought. I just always think God is a more positive thinking direction to be thinking in myself, but I kind of think in two ways when I do think of God. I think from a rational standpoint, I say to myself, there may be no God, but I think from a spiritual standpoint, I kind of take the position that there doesn't have to be one. That I can still utilize faith in a power greater than myself, in a higher power, in a God, in a earth spirit, whatever you want to call it, and whether there is one or not, that just that utilization of faith, working my faith and doing stuff with my faith, allows me to go out into the world and just do better works in the world. There's a quote by a guy who I have no idea who he is. His name is Peter DeVries, and the quote was, "It is the final proof of God's omnipotence that he need not exist in order to save us." And I've kind of taken that on as, a mantra, because I think that it helps me, whether there's a God or not, just to get through the world and do better. So I'll hang up and listen.
All right. You can react to his caller's thoughts any way you like.
There's actually so much that he brought up, I think that, one of the things that I did very much want to get across in the book is that I think, as the caller does, that this urge to get outside of ourselves and to see, to kind of revel in existence itself. The world is, as Cass Elster says, it's just such a tremendous thing. The intricacy of it, the beauty of the physical laws, just so much. I mean, art, mathematics, music, all of these things that have this power to draw us outside of ourselves. And I mean, the word ecstasy comes from the Greek meaning to stand beside what? Ourselves. This is one of the most powerful and expansive and wonderful human experiences. And it comes very naturally, as I say, to do religious expression of this experience, that when you feel this kind of wonder at existence itself and gratitude, it's permeated with a kind of feeling of gratitude, very natural to put it in religious language. But it is, I think, too big for simply religion. I think that we secularists are given to that experience as well. I mean, any artist has to be given to that experience. There's no art. There's really no creativity without that experience, not just in the arts, but in the sciences, I would say, as well. And so it is one of the things that I think happens is that those who are religious and put this larger than oneself experience in religious terms can sometimes think that if you don't have the religion, you can't have the experience, and you must be living a cramped and ego-driven life, and that, nothing else is available to you. And that's one of the reasons I so wanted to present an atheist with a soul, that this sort of experience that the caller was describing, and as he rightly says, doesn't really commit you to God. It's the experience itself, whichever way you describe it, that is the saving experience, that this sort of experience is not, exclusively religious. And the other thing that I so wanted to get across, and it's a related theme, is that goodness, ethics, morality, doesn't require God either. In fact, the whole history of moral philosophy is in trying to provide and providing a certain grounding for morality, which is independent of any theistic commitments. So that seems to me very, very important for a secularist to get out into the world. It's not that without the belief in God, we can't have these large world-embracing emotions and also can't act on ethical grounding.
All right. I appreciate the comments of the caller. Let's talk with someone else. This is someone in Crete, Illinois, line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. I just wondered if your distinguished guest has been compared to Ayn Rand and whether she thinks the works of Ayn Rand back in the last century, novels, philosophy, objectivism, the whole involvement that Ayn Rand was basically with at that time and still to some extent today as well, if she feels that there is anything that we can learn from Rand's books, Fountainhead and other works she did, as well as her philosophy called objectivism. And have you been compared yet to her?
Well, thank you. Thank you for that question. I'm going to have to make a confession, which is that I've never been able to get through any of Ayn Rand's novels. I'm not sympathetic to the philosophy of objectivism, and I'm not, it seemed to me a kind of, a Nietzschean view that I'm not sympathetic to, and I think reading her also makes me a little nervous in the sense that, I mean, I know that she's enormously popular and her views have been extraordinarily influential, but there's a great danger that I feel in my own writing, which is that I am motivated very much by philosophical questions in producing fiction. And I always feel the danger that the ideas that are sort of whirring around on the bottom, the hidden machinery, are going to, become very, very noisy, and everybody's going to be hearing this philosophical machinery under the plot line and the characters. And I worry about that as a novelist very much. And I felt that to be true when I was, you know, reading Ayn Rand. I mean, that was my own very personal reaction to it, that I could hear the ideas. The characters in the plot were so much in the service of the ideas that, to me, they didn't have a life of their own. And because I am so nervous about that in my own writing, I wasn't able to actually ever complete any Ayn Rand novel. So there's a confession.
Well, I think that's about the best response we can give to the question. We have about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Rebecca Goldstein. She's a novelist, also philosopher, has written in both of those areas, has written fiction, has written philosophy. Her new book is 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction, and it's published by Pantheon. Is out now in the bookstore, and certainly you can find it. Questions here, welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess I was thinking about some of the things that the first caller we took said, and it gets me back to something that I think is really striking, and that is if you go around, you ask people about, you know, where they are spiritually, and you ask people, do you believe in God? And there will be a lot of people who say, well, I'm not exactly sure. And then you say, are you involved in a church? And they would say, no. And then you say, do you think of yourself as a spiritual person? And I think a lot of those people will say, yes.
Yeah.
And I find that really interesting, and I suppose that what that makes you want to do is ask that person, well, okay, if you say that you're a spiritual person, what exactly does that mean? I mean, what is it that we seem to be a society that embraces spirituality but is not real sure about the other things?
Yeah. No, I think that's a really important question, and, you know, to admit to, you know, for most of us to say, no, I'm not a spiritual person, just seems to indicate a kind of lack of inner life or a largeness of spirit, or it's almost like saying, I don't like music. You know, what kind of person doesn't like music of any sort whatsoever? And I think, you know, when people are the thing, well, I think what one of the things that people are confirming is that, you know, spirituality and belief in God are not necessarily, you know, one and the same thing, that commitments to, when you're saying a belief in God is a commitment, and you usually need some grounds for it, saying that this universe is of a certain nature, and I'm conceiving my life in terms of my commitment to the universe being a certain way, having been created by a God, and perhaps a God who has a certain, or who probably does have a certain purpose in creating it in this way, and whose designs have something to do with how I should conceive of my own life. These are very large views about world, and very hard to get good grounds for. But that other experience that I really think is deeply rooted in human nature, of this coming outside of oneself and simply confronting the wonder of existence, whatever it is doesn't commit you in that way to any claims about the nature of the universe. One is religious and one is spiritual, and I think that's what people are getting at when they're making these distinctions.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk again with another caller here back in Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm a big fan. I want to thank you for your books. The Mind-Body Problem is probably the funniest book I've ever read.
Thank you.
And your new book I haven't read yet, but it's on my Kindle waiting for a free afternoon. But this morning's discussion has got me thinking sort of the opposite way, because I am not spiritual at all, and I'm not afraid to say that, and I don't believe in God, but religion to me is important. In fact, as I speak to you, I'm up to my elbows in flour because I'm making hummantaschen this morning.
Oh!
Because to me, religion is the community and
yes,
my connection
yes, yes, yes.
to other people.
Yes.
And I think that's very important. In fact, in The Mind-Body Problem, I thought that was really one of the themes as well. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, you're absolutely right. And actually, this is a very, very strong theme in the current book. And it is that religion is about so much more than belief in God. It's very much about loyalty to community, being moved by certain historical narratives, self-identity, all sorts of very personal ways of coming to terms with the existential dilemma of leading a human life. But of course, if you're going to write about, as a novelist, about religion, you have to be very, very specific. It can't be religion in general.
Right.
What does that even look like? It has to be concrete, and it has to be specific. Dostoevsky writes about this same dilemma between science and reason and faith and religion, he doesn't write about religion in general. He writes about the Orthodox Church. And I write about when I have to be concrete about religion. For me, that means Judaism. That's the religion I know best. It's the religion that I myself struggled so much of my life with. And the novel is the religion that is presented is Judaism, and is in fact extreme Orthodox Judaism. It's Hasidic Judaism. And I don't know if there is something about being Jewish that seems to accentuate the point that the caller is making, that religion is not necessarily about belief in God at all, that loyalty, the community loyalty to a particular historical narrative can override any ontological commitments whatsoever. And so the real heart of the novel concerns a little Hasidic boy who Cass Seltzer met when he was himself, when Cass was a graduate student. And this boy is actually the son of the head rabbi, and that in Hasidic circles is a hereditary position. So he's destined as the only son to become the head of this community. And if he doesn't, the community will cease to exist. And so he has a great feeling of obligation to it. And he is himself this extraordinary kid. I mean, he's a mathematical prodigy. And, the novel develops, and he has quite a dilemma that's really the heart of the book. And I hope does justice to the caller's very profound comment that religion is about many other things than belief in God and very much about community, obligations to community as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's continue. Get at least one more call. Here's someone in Chicago. Line 4. Hello.
Where to begin with such little time? In the beginning, they say in the Bible, they have so many interpretations of even that opening phrase in the different traditions. So where it begins and where it's going and how it'll all turn out, I have to ask you the personal question of the different arguments. Do you have a favorite?
Oh, of the different arguments, of the 36 arguments, do I have a favorite?
Or several that might balance off.
I do. Actually, so in the appendix, which was so much fun as a philosopher to write, and I deal with the standards, the oldies but goodies, the ontological argument and the cosmological argument and the teleological argument. These are all arguments that were formalized long ago, and St. Anselm and Thomas Aquinas. But then I come up with a lot more arguments, trying to get in some of the more emotional reasons that people have for believing in God. Like there's the argument from the intolerability of insignificance, or the argument from perfect justice. This world is so extremely unjust, there has to be an afterlife to right all of the injustices. Oh, anyway, there are 36 of them. My favorite is 35, and that's the argument for Spinoza's God, which is but Spinoza's notion of God was so quirky, so eccentric. It's not a transcendent God, and he really identifies his God with existence itself, with a sort of final theory of everything that explains not only what the laws of nature are, but why they had to be these particular laws of nature, and why they had to be realized in existence. That is an argument that says that eventually the universe will provide its own explanation.
Right.
And
okay, thank
that
you.
So the universe itself is a thing that's worthy of our awe and adoration. And it's an argument that excludes, if it's valid, or even possible, I guess, it excludes the possibility of a transcendent God. And that's why Spinoza was both described as a God intoxicated man and also described, you know, as an atheist, because his view of God is incompatible with the more traditional notions of God. Hmm. But anyway, that's the one I like. I like that number 35 very much.
We're coming down to just about the point we have to finish. And, you know, one thing I really want people to come away with is that while the book, the themes of the book are these sorts of weighty questions that we have talked about, that it is a book with a great sense of humor. It is a novel, and it is a very entertaining book, and I mean that in the best sense of entertaining. I kind of think that that's a word that should be rehabilitated. I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that something like this is an entertainment. But it's one that I think that really will engage people's thinking about this, because it does deal with some of these questions that are large and difficult. And it also is about love as well, which I think you would like to connect the experience of love, of being in love, in the over, you know, head over heels, out of your mind kind of a way.
The good kind.
The good kind, yeah. That there are, you can connect that with the sort of out of your mind kind of way that you can be when people are having religious experiences.
Yeah, absolutely right. That, you know, religiosity is such a mixed bag, you know, of positive and negative, of the completely delusional, but also the transformative and enlarging aspects. And romantic love is just like that. Such a mixed bag as well, with all of its delusions, but also possibilities for transformation and transcendence.
Yeah.
So, yes, I do see them as very parallel.
Yeah. And the other thing that I think we're just about out of time, but I guess I find myself thinking, well, we might want to, sometimes people who raise these questions or who say, want to engage in this conversation, is there a God or does religion matter, get written off as being atheists or people who are not spiritual. And it strikes me that maybe only somebody who really that having doubts is an indication of spirituality. That is, if you didn't have doubts, you wouldn't care. And what would be the point of the whole conversation?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. I think it is, in fact, such a precious, treasured part of our human nature that we care enough about the truth to entertain doubts. I mean, that is a measure of how much we care.
Yeah. Yeah, and I suppose I also feel like ending up with you know, Woody Allen's kind of response to Pascal's wager, that thing he said about, I don't know if there is an afterlife, but I'm taking a change of underwear just in case.
I think it's always right to give Woody Allen the last word on these subjects.
Well, at that, we want to say thanks to our guest, Rebecca Goldstein. It's a very good book, and I encourage people to take a look at it. Her new novel is 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction. It's just recently been published by Pantheon. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed myself.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe, offering lunches from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, and an early afternoon after hour from 1 to 3 p.m. featuring soups, sandwiches, salads, pastries, and specialty coffees. Bevere Cafe is student-operated in Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana. Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, Hudsonville, Illinois, and Crescent City, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. We're seeing some minor strength basically on short covering in the market.